Turn to 1 Corinthians 16 while you're being seated. And we're going to go ahead and work through this passage this morning. So I've entitled it The Essentials of an Effective Ministry. And basically, it's a kind of a catch-all chapter where the Apostle Paul has some final things he wants to say, and there's about five of them, so we're just going to tick them and say a few things about each of them as he does. And basically, I kind of look at these as things that should be effective in our lives, things that should be happening in our lives, as he expected them to be happening in the Corinthians' lives. And He spends some time on each of them, but not probably as much as he would like, because he spent a lot of time on the other topics in the rest of the book when he spent chapters and many, many verses. But here he just kind of ticks off about five or six things and makes some comments about them. And so these are things that ought to be operative in your life. So as I work through these, just ask yourself the question, is this happening in your life? Okay? That's what you should do. And as I'm doing, as I've gone through it, make note of it and ask yourself, you know, if it isn't, how it can, and if it is, how I can do more of it. Let's work through these. The first thing he says is in the first few handful of verses is we should participate in giving to the needy and the poor. So in verse 1, the Corinthians may have asked about giving, for instance, and this chapter is Paul's answer to that. Notice how he begins the chapter. Now, concerning the collection for the saints. All right. And who we will learn, by the way, in this case, had to do with the poor ones living in Jerusalem. Notice he says, as I directed to the churches in Galatia, so do you also. Now, James and Peter and John had encouraged Paul and Barnabas in the book of Acts, to remember the poor when they were in Jerusalem. You can read about that in Acts chapter 15 and in Galatians chapter 2, verses 9 and 10. So this is something that is close to the heart of the apostles and the disciples of Jesus. And so Paul says in verse 2, you know, the procedure for doing this, he says, in this case, in the city of Corinth, was that on the first day of the week, which would be Sunday, which was the traditional day of worship. There's no command for that in the New Testament, okay? Matter of fact, I think it's in Romans 14. Paul says, every day is to be sacred to the Lord. Not just Sunday. I know in West Michigan, many of you grew up in the tradition that Sunday was the Lord's day. I didn't mean you could do what you want to do on the other 6 days of the day, you know, the week, you know, revel and carouse and so on. But that's how you grew up. And I grew up in the tradition that Sunday was the Lord's day. But there's no command for that in the New Testament. Every day is to be holy unto the Lord. Now, I do believe in the principle of the Sabbath, not necessarily Sabbath keeping, but Sabbath rest. And that the idea is that somehow during the course of our week, there needs to be a day set aside where we are not doing the same thing we do all week long. And that part of that includes bringing the Lord into that day in some way. And so he says here that the traditional day, that each one of them were to set aside, put aside and save. On the first day of the week. So that's his counsel amounted basically to taking a little bit regularly and then setting it aside. He says, put aside and save as he may prosper, that no collections be made when I come. So the amount's up to the giver, which is the New Testament giving. New Testament giving is what you can probably define as storehouse giving. It's not tithing. Tithing is an Old Testament concept. If you lived under the law of Israel and you tithed, let's say you were faithful and devout as a follower of Jehovah, as an Israelite, then you would end up giving about 23% of your income and gross goods and product every year to the work of the kingdom. in the nation of Israel. That was tithing under the law. In the New Testament, we are told to give, here he says, as he says later in another passage, put aside and save as you may prosper. So we're responsible for the Lord to do storehouse giving, which means, in a crass way, you open up your cupboard, you pull out your cookie jar, you throw money in there from that week's earnings, and you put it back in the cupboard. And you do it again another time, and you get more income as you prosper. You pull some out, and you put it in the storehouse jar, and then you use that money for the work of the kingdom. In this case, some of it should be given to the poor and the needy. In other cases, it should be given in other ways. But you should have a portion of money set aside in your regular income that you utilize for the work of the kingdom. And it's as you are prospered. So basically, there's no percentage in the New Testament. A lot of people say, well, if it was 10%, well, actually it's 23%. It's not 10% under the law. Then that would be a good starting point. I have no idea. All I know is all the wealth that we have belongs to God. You know, if you choose that you're going to give 25% of your income to the work of the kingdom, that doesn't mean the other 75% is yours to do with it as you wish. You are accountable for the other 75% and what you do with it and how you use it as much as you are with the 25%, just as an illustration. So we're accountable to God for the way we use all of our money. And the Bible says we should spend it, we should save it, we should invest it, we should give it, we should party with it. We should do a lot of things with our money. And it's just a commodity, just like breathing is a commodity, just like food is a commodity. And we treat it with respect and we utilize it with biblical principles. So Paul says here, I'm going to come, I'm expecting all of you to put some money aside, and we're going to collect all that when we get there, and we're going to take it to Jerusalem, we're going to use it to help take care of the needs of our brothers and sisters in Christ in the city of Jerusalem who are poor and needy. So each believer was encouraged to give. Verse 3, he planned to send some representatives, apparently, from each of the contributing groups of believers all throughout Achaia. Now, Achaia is a province. We could say, just for comparison, if we were writing this today and we wanted to contemporize, is that how you say it? That's right. We would say all of the believers gathered all throughout the state of Michigan. The Apostle Paul and his team are going to come through, and they're going to sweep through the east side of the state, and they're going to pop up part of the UP and come back down the west side, and they're going to just meet with believers all across the state of Michigan and collect from them monies that they set aside individually for all of the poor believers in the city of Detroit. And so they're going to collect those monies, and that's basically what's going on. And Corinth happened to be one of those cities where Paul was going to send a group to collect the money. And he says, when I arrive, whomever you may approve that he's going to send in his behalf, because he can't be everywhere, I will send them with letters to carry your gift to Jerusalem. Now, the letters he's speaking about here are letters with his name on it, or maybe one of the apostles, as a guarantee that the money was collected and it will be utilized for the purposes in which it was collected, with the apostles' authority attached. In verse 4, he left open the possibility that he could go with the representatives himself and carry the money all the way to Jerusalem. He says, and if it is fitting for me to go also, they will go with me. Obviously, Paul's not sure he's going to be able to make this trip for whatever reason. We don't know. But we do know this. After he wrote this letter to the Corinthians, we do know that he did then decide to go to Rome. And indeed, he went to Rome. And obviously, he didn't make it to Jerusalem at that point. But nonetheless, what we learn from this is that we should be generous. We should set aside a portion of our income. We should utilize it for the work of the kingdom. Some of the work of the kingdom includes giving to the poor and the needy. I got a phone call yesterday on the way home. I was at a wedding Friday night and Saturday on the other side of Detroit. And so I'm driving home. I had a text message or a phone message from somebody, and they left a message for me to call them. So I'm driving home, so what better thing to do at 10 o'clock at night than to start making phone calls, right? But I knew he lived in Wisconsin, so I knew it was only 9 o'clock. So I was safe. So I called him up, and we chatted. And his concern was with something that related to somebody who's been a real giver in a particular ministry that he was referring to. And he wanted to remind me that, you know, there's some things that are happening that would be beneficial to this person who's been such a giver for so long to so many people and so many kinds of needs, and that he wanted to alert me to that so that we could kind of ensure that some of his needs, not financial, but some of his needs were going to be met and people could step up and assist him. And I thought that was cool. But we should be givers. And I don't know how generous you are. I would just put this challenge out to you and to me and to moi here. Be more generous than you've been. Okay? That's the challenge. Be more generous than you've been. As you think into the future, don't pat yourself on the back and say, I've been very generous. Let me challenge you this morning to even be more generous. Whatever that means for you, whatever that looks like, and wherever that would go. And I think that's the challenge. Now, with that in mind, he begins in verse 5 with a second point. He says, plan for the future, but be flexible. Okay? Don't get so rigid. I remember listening to B.R. Lakin many years ago. He was a preacher from West Virginia. He was one of the last circuit riders. He actually rode on horseback to several towns and villages in the mountains of West Virginia for years. And I got a chance to hear him speak in the 70s. He was probably pushing 80 at that point. And he was a very provocative and emotional evangelist preacher. And he was just a joy to listen to, man. He just was awesome. But I remember him one time saying, you know, I'm going to plan like I'm going to live for the next 50 years. But then I live as if today may be the last day I ever have. Great advice, right? And I think that's what Paul's saying. And maybe he got it from Paul, probably. Plan for the future, but be flexible. So in verse 5, Paul's travel plans are tentative to some extent. At the time he wrote, he says, he planned to head north to Ephesus and then spend some time in Macedonia. So it's like he's going to go from Grand Rapids up to Traverse City, and then he's hoping to spend some time over in Alpena. Okay, that's kind of what we're talking about here. And he says, but I will come to you after I go through Alpena. All right, I'll make it down to you guys, for I'm going to go through Macedonia. Now, think about this. When you study the Old Testament and the New Testament, isn't travel an important contribution to the work of the kingdom around the world? I mean, you think about all the traveling happening in the Old Testament. You know, God, we're going to take you here, and then God's going to take you there, and then God wants you to go here. In the new, in the life of Jesus, you know, strategic travel, the life of the apostles. Trips like you've taken to Jamaica. I'm going to be taken to Poland and other places that I've gone and you've gone. Travel makes a significant, important contribution to the work of the kingdom around the world. It really does. And Paul once again says here, this is what I'm hoping to do. In verse 6, he says, he had hoped that perhaps I will stay with you when I come. And maybe I'll even spend the winter with you. Right? Nobody wants to be traveling around, even in that part of the world, in the winter. Now, originally, he had intended to visit briefly to Corinth on his way to Alpena. All right, so that would have been to, let's say, Lansing, up on his way up to Alpena. He had planned to do that, he'd hoped, but he had revised those plans afterward, apparently, and he decided for a longer stay through winter that he hoped to be there with them in Corinth. And the reason for these plans, he says, was so that you may send me on my way wherever I may go. In other words, possibly wanting the Corinthians, while he spent more time with them during the winter months, and hung around, that they would be willing to financially support him as he continued on his ministry in the other cities. Now, plans are proposals. What are plans? Plans are proposals we make for doing or achieving something. Okay? So you make a plan, and you want to do or achieve something. Now, the Bible encourages us to make plans. Okay? It encourages us to make plans. As long as they don't produce anxiety or they cause worry. So we understand that that our plans are subject to God's sovereignty. That's the point. So don't make plans so you get to the point of worrying, or you assume that you're in charge of your future. You don't know what the future holds. Make the plans. They should guide our decisions, but keep them tentative and flexible as much as possible. Verse 7, apparently Paul changed his mind about visiting the Corinthians then. He had all these plans set. Because winter conditions, he thought he didn't want to stay just for a brief time. So he says, I don't wish to see you now just in passing due to the significant problems that they were having in Corinth, for I hope to remain with you for some time. He wanted to obviously spend a longer time with them. But he didn't presently know what the Lord wanted, so he said, if the Lord permits. And he did spend winter with them, by the way, but if you look at the record, it was the following winter. It wasn't the one he was referring to here. So it was a year later that he was able to do that. Verse 8, for the time being, though, he says, due to Pentecost and deciding to stay on in Ephesus for the meantime, he says, I will remain in Ephesus until Pentecost, where both opportunities and opposition were great. Make plans, but keep them flexible. So in verse 9, he says, the reason he's staying in Ephesus, that is, in Traverse City instead of going to Lansing, is, he says, for a wide door for effective service has opened to me. That word wide door means to stand open. It's like you're standing there and the doors aren't shutting. They're just staying wide open, and it's bidding you to go through them because there's something there for you. When we lived in Dallas, Texas, the year before we were married, I spent 1 year in Dallas, and then the last 3 years in seminary I was married. That first year, I started pastoring a church called Trinidad Baptist Church, about 60 miles south of Dallas, in the middle of nowhere. You go right through Tool, Texas. You know where Tool, nobody knows Tool, Texas. It's smaller than Trinidad. You go right through Tool, Texas to Trinidad. And I got to know some great friends there, and one of them was named Bernice, Joe and Bernice Stubblefield. Joe and Bernice. And Bernice, she had that southern Texas drawl, and I can remember when I was leaving the first year I was there, and I was leaving at the end of the year, not returning because I was getting married and going to seminary and had other things to do. She said, Jerry, we need to pray for you. I said, I'll take all the prayer you can give me. Yeah, we got to pray that God opens a door for you. A wide door. Just wide. Wide. Just a wide door. That was great. Never forgot that. Wide. Oh, it was hilarious. That's what this word is. This is the word for an effective door. A wide door. Been opened to me. And so Paul sees that door in Ephesus up in Traverse City, and he says, you know, I was going to come down and spend the winter. I'm going to spend the winter up here. I want to spend more time with you than just coming through. We need to talk about things. So you know what? A door's open here for me in Ephesus. I'm going to stay here. It's a wide door. And he actually remained in Ephesus for a good part of 3 years, or in Ephesus for about 3 years. That's how much the opportunity was there for him. And he says, though, in verse 9, there are many adversaries. That didn't deter him, though. He didn't hightail it out of there. He hung in there. He didn't regard adversaries, by the way, as an indication that God closed the door. Interesting. Sometimes we think, this is what I need to do, and then we get a little opposition, and we thought, well, maybe that's not what I should do. Right? And that didn't happen to him. So make plans, but be flexible. So he gives a little bit of that information here. Here's the third thing. The third thing is pursue what you believe to be a correct course of action. Pursue what you believe to be the correct course of action. Verse 10, in the meantime, with all that said, Paul was going to send Timothy in his place to Corinth to visit the people there. He's going to stay up in Traverse City for the coming winter. He wanted to go. He altered his plans, a doors opportunity in Ephesus. He still wants the Corinthians to collect money so they can be eventually collected by the apostles taken to Jerusalem. But in the meantime, he decides to send Timothy on his behalf to Corinth. And he wanted Timothy to go to facilitate the collection and to see what was going on and the compassion and so on and cooperation of the Corinthians. So he says in verse 10, now if Timothy comes, All right? Now, Timothy's his young disciple. He's the young buck here. He says, if Timothy comes, see that he is with you without cause to be afraid. I think that's interesting. Because, frankly, the Corinthians could be rascals. They could be brutal. They could be hard. And he says, evidently, Timothy's relative youth and the fact that he is somewhat, timid and so on, he might be vulnerable to stuff, maybe criticism or who knows what. We don't know. Paul advised the Corinthians, who apparently like to judge external appearances, that's what they were into, you know. Remember, I want to be of Paul and I want to be of Apollos and so on. He says, give him the respect he deserves. Why? For he's doing the Lord's work, so as I am also. So verse 11 goes on. So let nobody despise him, especially since the Corinthian church may have been tempted to look down on him because he was a young runt of some kind, even though he was Paul's protege. Instead, he says, send him on his way in peace. The word peace there is tranquility and harmony. In other words, don't rile him up. Don't get him all agitated. He's a young guy. He's got some, he's growing up to do, but he's the guy I've discipled, and I'm sending him in my place under my authority. And so see that he comes in peace so that he may come back to me that way. It almost sounds, Paul doesn't want Timothy coming back, and he's got to put his arms around him to take care of him. He's, he's a basket case, depressed and discouraged and despondent. Paul's admonition was a way of giving Timothy respect in the eyes of the Corinthians. Again, I think the Corinthians are one of the toughest bunch that Paul had to deal with in all of his ministry. So he anticipated Timothy coming back along with other associates like Titus and Erastus, and to be briefed about the situation in Corinth, because he says, for I expect him to return with the brethren. So apparently there were other people there in addition to Timothy that he wanted to come back and visit him afterward. So evidently, verse 13 or 12, the Corinthian church asked about the possibility of the gifted Alexandrian from northern Africa. Apollos was his name, a firebrand guy, opposite of Timothy. Okay? So apparently they ask about Apollos coming to visit him, because they like that. They want the glitter and the shiny. And, Apollos was a good guy, so I'm not knocking him. It's just the Corinthians like to have that kind of thing because they felt like, they were put on the map and they got some shiny stuff going on. Timothy, well, not so much. So they wanted to know about Apollos coming back. So Paul says in verse 12, but concerning Apollos, our brother, I encouraged him greatly to come to you with the brethren. Paul had no authority, of course, over Apollos to make him do anything he wanted him to do. But he says, but it was not at all his desire to come right now. But he will come to you when he has opportunity. We don't know why Apollos never showed up. It's just interesting that the Corinthians wanted Apollos and Paul had to make sure he propped up Timothy before he got there. The shiny and bright guy, and then Timothy, the runt and the young guy. So it just gives you a little bit of background here. But, when you know what you believe the correct course of action is, then go for it. Right? Don't hesitate. Paul's saying, he's putting it on the line, saying, this is what I think and this is what you should do. Here's the fourth thing, beginning of verse 13. Practice diligently those things that bring strength, not weakness. So beginning of verse 13, in the absence of powerful personalities like Paul or Apollos in Corinth, they must learn themselves to stand up and be counted. He says to them, be on the alert. Stand firm in the faith. Act like men. Be strong. That word men there is the word for maleness. He's talking specifically about be men, be brave, be manly. And that's what he wanted them to do. Now, they had asserted themselves. The Corinthians had done that. They had asserted themselves when they should have shown restraint. And then they were passive when they should have purged evil in the church. They had it backwards. But now with the issues clear, the time had come for them to act. No more complacency, Paul says. Carry out your calling and get serious about your following of Christ. Do business amongst yourselves. Quit depending upon outsiders to have to come in and do that for you. You've grown up enough. You know enough of the truth. Now take responsibility. Verse 14, but above all, he says, love should motivate and mark them. He says, let all that you do be done in love. That was the greatest need in the church. Matter of fact, he wrote a whole chapter about it in chapter 13. Now, if the Corinthians were listening, when they heard Paul say this in one little snippet in the end of the book, they would have remembered, well, he had a whole lot to say about that when he wrote this in the middle of the letter and gone back to reread it. Because that's what he meant. Love should be the controlling principle. So, practice diligently those things that bring strength and turn you into men and women who take responsibility for your spiritual walk with Christ. Quit depending upon everybody else to do it for you. There's nothing wrong with listening to somebody like me or some preacher or read some book or go to some conference. There's nothing wrong with any of that if you're doing it to enhance your responsibility to take charge of your walk with Christ. But don't depend upon them to do it for you. See, you're going to stand before Christ on your own. So the question you should ask yourself this morning is, am I taking that responsibility seriously? And that's the call here, I think, that he has for us. Beginning of verse 15, here's another. I think it's the last one, right? And then we have closing greetings. So number 5 here. Point out godly leaders and acknowledge them. Point them out and acknowledge them. So in verse 15,